As is my habit, I'm going to try to give you guys some resources. So what we're talking about here, I'll come down here a little. You can see on the slide in front of you there, an overview. The question is that of worship and an overview of our commitments, where they come from and how they shape us. Now, I'm going to address some of these matters in quicker fashion in a sermon coming up fairly soon, probably on the other side of the missions conference. The reason for talking about this is, back in November, I'd say, in a session meeting, right? That's the Board of Elders. We were in a session meeting, and I went through with the elders in about 45 minutes or so some of the material that we're going to discuss in the next 3 or 4 weeks. And that is a short, brief, biblical theology of worship. Why do we do things the way we do them? We have a unique situation at Surfside where we've got two distinct styles of worship. We have a contemporary service and a traditional service. Whatever you do with that distinction, however you define those terms, that's the terminology that for years and years we've settled on, and the Lord has blessed that. And yet there are questions about them, and our task is to make sure that whatever it is that we do, we have good biblical grounding, and we are rooted in the best of the past. So that's where we're going to go. You might be surprised to learn that both our traditional service and our contemporary service are actually both very deeply rooted in hundreds of years of theology and history and study. And so we don't just willy-nilly choose to do random things. Rather, there is a theological system, a biblical system, more importantly, that informs our decisions. And so we're going to give ourselves to that the next few weeks. And then, as I said, we're going to there'll be a Sunday coming up where those of you that are here will be, this will be something of a repetition. I think we're being recorded. And so I realize some will listen because we have 30 or so people down in the other, taking the other class tonight as well, and they'll want to hear some of this too. So, resources. You see in fine print on the screen there, much of the stuff that we're going to talk about these next few weeks, it's very fitting to give proper due to Brian Chappell. Brian Chappell was for 30 years, the president of our denomination's seminary, called Covenant Theological Seminary. That's in Missouri. He was the leader of that seminary for a lot of years. He's now pastoring a church in Illinois or Indiana or someplace cold and too cold. And anyway, he has written a number of books, Christ-centered, his sort of classic book is Christ-centered preaching. He's got another book. It's called Holiness by Grace, a prolific author, a fine, fine scholar, and a true gentleman. I am fond of him on a personal level. And this book is called Christ-Centered Worship. So that's where you see there. As always, it's fitting to give. Now, this is a book. It's very accessible, meaning it's very easy for any. You don't have to be a scholar to read and follow what he's talking about, although he does get into the weeds of some things. And just put that in your mind if you'd like to. This book is called Contemporary Worship Music, A Biblical Defense, written by John Frame. Dr. Frame is, for many years, was a professor of systematic theology at Westminster Seminary, and is one of those brainiac types. Hard to understand some of his stuff, only because he's just so heady, and you're just like, whoa. Okay, this is a very interesting book. I'll leave these up here. I know each time I do this, somebody likes to take pictures of them as you build your own collection of books, which I think is really exciting. This is an interesting book called Ancient Future Worship, part of a series of Ancient Future everything, ancient future, such and such, ancient future. This one is Ancient Future Worship by Robert Weber, a classic called Proclaiming and Enacting God's Narrative. Then this book is simply called Worship by the Book. It's got a biblical rationale for worship from four different perspectives. An Anglican has himself in here, and an E.V. Free pastor has one, a PCA pastor, Tim Keller, has one. All right, four good books for you. Now, on to our purposes tonight. I think we'll go till 7:15 or so tonight. So, a little comedy here. If you want to hit that next slide, Ricky or Ken or somebody. We're going to take equal shots at all parties here. So what do you do for a living? Says one man. I write modern worship courses. I write modern worship courses. I write modern worship courses. You get the joke? The narrative of modern worship courses, the 7-Eleven humor. Well, our contemporary friends are not the only target. Next slide is the traditional man talking in front of a gigantic electric organ to a young electric musician. Oh, for me, these electric instruments just distract from true worship, right? So we're taking equal pot shots at both sides of the debates. So, what are we after? We are after a biblical and theological rationale for worship, the way we do worship. We are not, as I said, randomly selecting willy-nilly whatever we just prefer. Preference is important, but preference is not the main thing. Biblical rationale, theological rationale, and dying to the self for the sake of the church, that's the main thing, right? So, we want to talk about worship. So, if you have your Bibles open to Isaiah chapter 6, we're going to walk through this chapter together that serves as a paradigm. Go ahead. Yeah, thank you. A biblical paradigm of worship. A biblical paradigm of worship. I have a new little toy here that I'm just so excited to try out. So that says the biblical paradigm of worship. And that says Isaiah 6. Isn't that cool? And it says it over here, too. Yeah, that's right. Who's talking to me?
Nobody.
Isaiah 6, biblical paradigm of worship, a famous passage. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him stood the seraphim. Each had six wings. With two he covered his face. With two he covered his feet. And with two he flew. And one called to the other and said, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." And the foundations of the thresholds shook at the voice of him who called. And the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." Then one of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that he had taken with tongs from the altar. And he touched my mouth and said, "Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin atoned for." And I heard the voice of the Lord saying, "Whom shall I send and who will go for us?" Then I said, "Here I am, send me." And he said, "Go and say to this people, keep on hearing but do not understand. Keep seeing but do not perceive. Make the heart that is of this people dull and their eyes heavy. Blind their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and turn and be healed." So the narrative will go on and on. Now, what's this got to do with worship? So here's the plan. We're going to walk through this together. I have a series of slides that we'll go through, and we're going to walk through this together, and I'm going to help, I hope, my goal is to help us see how Isaiah 6 helps frame our thoughts about worship. And then we're going to see how that frame, how that paradigm or that program is present everywhere in the Old Testament. And we'll look at a few key places of that. We'll start to see how this is everywhere, and then we'll find a greater fulfillment of that in the New Testament with the paradigms of the New Testament. That's where we're going to go. Okay, does that make sense? So let's talk about this passage, Isaiah 6. What do you notice about those first four verses? Go ahead. So, in the year of the Lord, the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne. How is the Lord here described in those bold verses? What are some of the things that come to mind? How is God here described? King? Holy, majestic. What are some of the things that make you say that? Right? His character is recognized here. What are some of the things that stand out to you? So you see right here, right? So he's got a throne, not just a throne, but a throne that is exalted. That's what high and lifted up means. What's that? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, so that's his... Okay, the train of his robe does what to the temple? It fills it. What's the symbolism here? What is the train of the robe of a king doing? It's declaring that this one, this is one that is worthy of all the adoration that he is receiving. And it fills the whole temple, the train of his robe. It's a picture of the fullness of the glory of God. And then above this glorious God are the seraphim. These are the angels, particular kind of angel, if you will. They fly. And they've got six wings. And what are they doing with their wings? They're covering their faces, right? And they're covering themselves, and they're flying with one set of wings. Why that? Why this part? Why are they covering their face and covering their feet? Because he's holy. Why covering the feet? Do you know about this ancient history? What?
Their humanness.
It communicates their humanness. And to show one's...
Modesty.
Okay, so modesty. Oftentimes, do you remember years ago when President Bush was... over in the Middle East, and somebody took off their shoe and threw it at him. That wasn't just because that was the nearest thing he had. There is something about that. That is in the Middle East, and true of the ancient Middle East. It was a what's that? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. So all of that is here. So they will reveal their feet to people as a way of declaring their disgust with that person. If I show you my feet, okay, a certain contempt. The angels are covering their feet. Okay, this is a different context of loose thy shoes from off thy feet, for the ground whereon thou standest is holy ground. One of those great King James ways to memorize that. It's a different context of that. And then with the two flutes, so he's covering himself. He is declaring everything about him. Okay, and then one is calling to the other, the famous. We have a song that we sing often, holy, holy, holy. They're declaring, they're singing as they encounter the greatness of God. Even the angels, these sinless creatures, are covering themselves. And they are declaring by their posture, and they're declaring with their words, holy, holy, holy. I heard somebody once years ago say that the reason that the thrice holy is because there's no Hebrew word for very. But that's not true. I studied Hebrew and I thought, that means very. This is very intentional. The thrice holiness of God is, it is saying that God is holy once is not sufficient, and it's meant to be superlative. It's meant to be overflowing, the holiness of God. So they say, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. And now we have up here the temple, right there, my little toy, the temple. And now we see where the true temple is. What is this a picture of? The whole earth is filled with his glory. The handiwork of God's creation extends. His glory extends over all of it. So the whole temple is filled with the train of his glory. Now the angels are singing, the seraphim, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God of hosts, or the Lord of hosts. And the foundations of that earth, these foundations of this earth, are shaking at the voice of him who called. And the house was filled with smoke. It is a picture and a portrait of the character of God. Yeah, go ahead.
I remember reading the Holy, Holy, Holy. It was in part due to in the mouth of two or more witnesses.
Huh.
Which would make three.
Okay. I hadn't heard that, but so again, it sort of speaking of the authenticity of this and of the boots on ground reality of these angels and their testimony. And God is filling the whole temple. So the basic idea here is that God's character is recognized. So you put that in your mind. The first thing, remember, we're viewing Isaiah 6 as a first foray into a biblical understanding of what worship truly is. The first thing about worship that has to be recognized is that it is about God. All worship is about God. So the rhetorical question that you'll all know the answer to immediately, therefore, worship is not about us. From beginning to end, worship is about God. I mentioned Brian Chappell. He says in several places that worship always begins and worship always ends with God. It is about God. If we are not coming to worship God, then whatever it is that we're doing, it's not worship. But it's not just God. This God is defined. This God is revealed. And as he reveals himself, the first way that he reveals himself to sinners is holy. He is with Adam and Eve in their sinless estate. Then they sin. What happens? Does God change? God doesn't change. But now sin is present in a whole new way. What does God do? First off, they cover themselves. Isn't that interesting? And they're shamed now because sin, and God banishes them. He atones for them, he provides for them, but he banishes them. Because God is infinitely holy. From the very moment God has dealt with sinful man, God has been declared holy. It is the most natural instinct to a human being to see God and fall before him. If we were to look at the biblical examples of people who meet God. Some of them fall in worship. Some of them fall dead. There's an instinct at the holiness of God. And the first way that God reveals himself is holy. So much so that even at the end of the book of Revelation, John, the author of the Revelation, the author of the book of John, sees an angel, not even God, but sees an angel who is sinless, but he's not infinitely holy, and his instinct is to fall down and worship. And the angel says, don't do that, I'm a creature like you. How much more glorious is God if that is true of man seeing an angel? So the first biblical principle of worship or paradigm of worship is to center it in God's holiness, God's character as glorious and holy must always be before us. That's what defines. That does not mean joylessness. Don't mistake holiness for joylessness. God's holiness is the source of our joy and happiness and gladness. All right, so that's the first little step, the first arrow. I'm going to reveal, have another kind of way of looking at all this in a few minutes. Slide 6. The biblical paradigm of worship. Now we come to verse 5. And I said, "Woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. For my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." So what has happened? What has happened between that verse and that verse? What's happened right in between that period and the beginning of that word? He's looking at himself. And what's the mirror? God himself. So he's seeing himself now against the backdrop of a great, exalted, highly lifted up God and King. And his instinct is the right instinct. This is man's sinfulness. Is man's sinful nature. If the first few verses reveal God's nature, God's character, Isaiah, the prophet, this is no rebel child. This is Isaiah, the prophet, and he sees God, and his instinct is to say, "Woe is me. Woe is me." Why? For I am lost. And then just do some commenting on that little phrase. I am lost. I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Just talk through that. What do you suppose this is touching on? His sinfulness, his... there's echoes here of out of my heart doth my mouth speak. This is the very self that's in view here. I'm a man of unclean, and I'm living among unclean people. Everything about us, we see you high and lifted up, but everything about us is unclean against your holiness. If I am lost, that means I need to be found. It means I am undone. It means, therefore, I am not whole. I'm dwelling amongst these people. And then, for my eyes have seen the King. Just in case we missed what happened between verse 4 and verse 5, we pick it up again down here. For my eyes have seen the King. So God's glory, God's character is revealed in worship. And then man's character is revealed in worship. But then the remarkable happens at verse 6. One of the seraphim flew to me, having in his hand a burning coal that's been taken with tongs from the altar. Interesting little twist there. Tongs have taken it from the altar, and now it's in this angel's hand. And he touched my mouth, and he says, "Behold, this has touched your lips, and your guilt is taken away." Atonement. Your sin is atoned for. This angel, this messenger of God, has come, and he has proclaimed atonement. So if we begin with God and God's holiness, against the backdrop of that holiness, I see my utter pollution. And none of this is good news. God's holiness is very bad news for the unbeliever, the one for whom there is no atonement and guilt is not taken away. God's holiness is very bad news. So here's Isaiah. I see God's holiness, and my goodness, woe is me. I need something. I can't be here. I can't stand in his presence. I'm lost. I'm unclean. Everywhere I look is uncleanness. And then God's grace is offered. God's grace is received. God's grace is affirmed. He touched my mouth and he said, behold, this touched your lips, this burning coal that is taken away. It has killed the pollution. That's the picture here. It has killed the pollution. The source of the pollution is here, and this has come right to where it is flowing from, and it has cleansed it. And just in case we don't capture the picture of that, the explanation: now your guilt is taken away, and your sin is atoned for. So we start with God. Worship is about God. We see the self. The self is unworthy. The self is unholy. I need something. I need mercy. I need grace. And then we see grace here, verses 6 and 7. And then God has something for Isaiah. Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, whom shall I send? So he's now been made whole. He's now been made whole. His sin is atoned for. He has been cleansed. Guilt is taken away. Much more we could say on guilt and sin and so on. But then I heard the voice of the Lord, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? And God said, here I am, send me. Or Isaiah says, here I am, send me. So now he's listening. So now God, it's about God. Worship is about God. It is always about God. It is always about God's holiness, God's character. It's about the self that sees and recognizes need for atonement. That atonement is given. There is grace that is given. There's a picture here, a portrait of Christ that we'll come back to. And this grace is given. And now that I have received grace, I am renewed in grace. I am renewed in grace. And following that, I get instruction from God, because God has mission. Whom shall I send? Who will go? Who will go where? What's that about? Who will do what? Go. Well, what's God have in mind here? Who will do what? Go and tell. Go and tell about what? That. Go and tell about God and his holiness, and that human beings before him, woe are they. Woe is me. Go. Who will go and tell the world of this? Who will go and tell the neighbor of this? And so there is a charge that is here. There is godly instruction in this scene. Remember, we're in the temple, the place of worship. That's where this is unfolding in his vision, Isaiah's vision. And he responds and says, here I am, send me. So there is a response. There is God's instruction given, and then God calls for our response in verse 9 and 10. Then he said, go and say to this people, and then this little bit, keep on hearing, don't understand, keep on seeing, don't perceive. There's more to say on exactly why that's the language, but the message is go and tell them. So go. So that's the response. Your response is to go in obedience to what it is that God says. So that gives us a little bit of a portrait. What does it do? It starts with God's character. Biblical paradigm of worship always starts with God's character. And always moves to man's character, a sinful character. And then God's grace comes to sinful people. And that grace is offered, and that grace is affirmed. And then God's gracious to give us instruction on how to respond, and he requires of us a response. That's what happens in the Isaiah vision of God. Biblical paradigm of worship. There is the prophet's way of understanding how human beings encounter God, also known as worship. But there is more. So, Ricky, hit the next one. The biblical paradigm of worship. We won't go through this in quite the same detail. Biblical paradigm of worship to be found at Mount Sinai and in the Old Testament temple. So what happens there? In Deuteronomy chapter 5, as a matter of fact, you don't have to go there, but let me just read this. And you just follow along. You see the outline there, don't you? So Deuteronomy 5, there are two places in the Old Testament where the law is given. The Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. Fancy word for that is the Pentateuch. And the moral law of the Ten Commandments is given twice, Exodus 20 and again at Deuteronomy 5. So here, Deuteronomy 5, the Ten Commandments. Moses, now you've got the little outline there of human beings encountering God. Moses summoned all Israel and said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes, the rules that I speak in your hearing today, and you shall learn them and be careful to do them. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb, not with our fathers, the Lord made this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today. The Lord spoke with you face to face at the mountain out of the midst of the fire, while I stood between the Lord and you at that time to declare to you the word of the Lord, for you were afraid because of the fire, and you did not go to the mountain." As he said, God's character of one who speaks, God's holiness. If you remember from the parallel passage in Exodus 20, the smoke that's on the mountain, God's holiness and God's character. Man is about to encounter God. Moses will be their mediator. Same thing is happening here. And God is speaking. And when God speaks, the earth trembles and shakes. God's character is revealed. Man's sinful character comes next in verse 5. While I stood between the Lord and you. Why that? Because we need a mediator. Because I'm sinful. So when I see God, I have to have a mediator here. No man can see God and live. That's why Moses has the veil here. He's actually standing between God and the people. It's a declaration, a confession, if you will, of man's character, of a sinful character. And so we, like Isaiah, would say, I'm lost, I'm undone. God is too holy for me. Then verse 6, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That is a declaration of God's mercy. That is God's grace. I did this for you. I brought you out of the house of slavery. You didn't work your way out of the house of slavery. I got you out of that. There's nothing inherent in you, O Israel, that makes me say, wow, those are the most lovely people on earth. I'm going to rescue them. If anything, it's the opposite. But yet God came to them and redeemed them out of Israel. And this is the declaration of God's grace. Their need of this grace is because God is so holy, they must have a separation. God is there. And now God has said, but I have brought you here. Character of God. Worship always begins the character of God. Man's sinfulness. God's grace in response. And then verse 7 to 31, all kind of instruction, including the Ten Commandments are given, God's gracious instruction. And then verse 32 at the end, 32 and 33, you shall be careful, therefore, to do as the Lord your God has commanded you. You shall not turn aside to the right or to the left, shall walk in all the way the Lord your God has commanded you, that you may live, may go well with you, that you may live long in the land that you shall possess, God's call for our response. These are the instructions. God calls us to respond in obedience and in holiness. So Isaiah, same pattern. God's character, man's character, the need of grace. Grace is offered, grace is received. Following that is godly instruction and a response to go. That's Isaiah's vision of encountering God. That is Mount Sinai's vision of encountering God. And then the temple. This isn't working well. The temple. Now, the temple, it takes a little more doing. Exodus 40 begins this whole description of the temple. So what you know of the temple, what is it, if you are an ancient Israelite, do you remember that the temple had the step? We're not talking about the tabernacle, the mobile version. This is the permanent version. It's how it is described to have been built and constructed under Solomon eventually. But the pattern is here. And as they approach here, meaning in Exodus 40, and as they approach the temple, what would strike them in Old Testament ancient Israel as they are approaching the temple? Shekinah glory. Yeah, God is here. It's the grandeur of God. You can't miss that. The marble and the pillars and the stones and eventually the steps that are leading up to it. The Psalms of Ascents, that's Psalms 120 through 134. There's 15 of them. There's 15 steps. And then they think that with each step, as they come up, the leader would sing and the congregation would respond in singing Psalm 120. Then they would go to the next one, Psalm 121. They're singing and declaring of who God is as they get closer and closer. God's character is revealed. And then they enter the tabernacle, if you remember, or the temple. If you remember the picture there, you're an ancient Jew and you walk into the temple. What's the first thing you must do? You got to wash yourself. What are you declaring? You walk into the temple. And don't take any more steps. You stop right here and you look over here and there's a washing basin. What do? You cleanse yourself. Why are you doing that? What are you declaring? Your own pollution. So there's all manner of these ritualistic purification ceremonies that take place. And then God's grace is affirmed because you've washed yourself. And when you've cleansed yourself, God is drawing there. So these same purification rites are happening with God's grace. It is eminently gracious of God to summon sinners into his presence. And you must come cleansed. And we know as the greater New Testament fulfillment of all this, is that God is saying, not only must you come cleansed, but I'm the one who cleanses you. So I go to you and cleanse you and then bring you into my presence. That's beginning to be painted for us. That picture is beginning to be painted here in the temple. So the same pattern. Isaiah's vision, character of God, man's sinful character of man. God's grace is promised and received following instruction of God, which is itself rather gracious. And then God's call for our response. And then in Mount Sinai, when God meets man there, same pattern. Here in the temple, the same pattern. Those are some biblical verses for you to reference on your own and see a greater fulfillment of that in John 1. Then there is something that is called the ascension offering, which you can read about in Leviticus 6. This is where God gives instruction. And then finally, the fellowship offerings and God's call for response. As you enter the tabernacle, you make your washings, and you go a little bit further in, you complete your washings, and eventually you get to a place where you make sacrifice. And you can make sacrifice for your family, you can make sacrifice for the poor. These are the fellowship offerings as the community is gathering. This is God's instruction for them, and this is God's call for their response. And so it's the same pattern, interacting with God. So go ahead and hit the next slide. Here's a little bit of a summary of this. The consistent message of Old Testament worship is the anticipation of the gospel. The consistent message of the Old Testament is anticipation of the gospel. God's glory, man's need, grace given and grace received, and mission in life. Here's my instruction for you. Here's what I expect of your response. That's what this is about. All worship is this. Now, let me just pause and ask this question. What else is this? God's glory, man's need, grace offered, grace received, and mission in life. This is God's glory, and this is our story. This is the story of your conversion. The whole thing about it. It's not just ancient Old Testament worship. You see how things tie together here? From Old Testament, we're going to talk about the new in just a minute, but I wanted to introduce this to you here. This is the story of every believer. You came across God's glory, and you recognize because somebody told you. You cannot earn your way into heaven because God is too holy. And so you must confess your own sinfulness and repent and turn. And when you do that, grace is offered. And when you trust and believe, grace is received. And when that happens, God says, now, like I said to Isaiah, so I say to you, go into all the world. Make disciples of them. Baptize them. Make disciples. This is the story of every believer. And it's all reflected in our worship services. When we come into worship, this story ought to be reflected. And I don't care if the song that you were singing was written in 1875 or 2005. And frankly, you shouldn't care either. And I don't care if it's done on a certain, I have my preferences. Sure I do. I have my preferences and so do you. There's not wrong with preferences. The problem is when we define ourselves, we define and describe our worship based on what is my preference and not based on the story that is being told in the worship service. Okay? So there's the Old Testament story. Why? Because this is a gospel anticipation in the Old Testament. It tells the story of every person who's come to Christ, and this whole story is reflected in the new. So if you flip over to the next slide. Incidentally, give me your feedback here. Do you notice that unlike the Old Testament, there is no explicit description of a worship service in the New Testament? So I was challenged again by Dr. Chappell with this question: why do you suppose there isn't? Why do you think that the Bible, this is not like a secret answer, what are some thoughts? Why does the New Testament not describe in detail a particular worship service experience in the New Testament? It's already established. Okay, so there's already a pattern. What else? Kathy, were you saying something? There's a fulfillment of something. It's already been told. The story is already laid out for us. Now it's fulfilled. If there was a detailed description of a worship service in the New Testament, what would you and I do with that? Right. First off, we would idolize it, and then we'd butcher it. We'd try to improve upon it and perfect it and so forth. And we'd find ourselves regulating things in a way that the Bible, New Testament, never means to regulate. We'll get to something called the regulative principle a little bit later on. No pattern in the New Testament. Now, there are rather no explicit description of worship, but there is a pattern that informs our worship life in the local church. What is that pattern? It's the same story of our own conversion. God's character, man's need, God's grace, instruction, and a response. You know where that comes from? It comes from the New Testament itself. We are studying, in God's kind providence, the book of Ephesians. The book of Ephesians follows this pattern. Chapter 1, the greatness and the glory of God. Blessed be God, Father of our Lord Jesus. Bless us with Christ, every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. He chose us in Him, foundation, that we should be like Him, holy and blameless. He predestined us. He adopted us to the praise of His great glory. Ephesians chapter 1, we spent some time there a few weeks ago, on and on and on about the glory of God. And then basically speaking, chapter 2, my sinfulness. I have to be saved by grace through faith. I can't bring anything. Nothing in my hands I bring is to the cross. I cling. And then you get into chapter 4, which we're going to be on Sunday. All of a sudden things change. The first three chapters in the book of Ephesians are about God, His character, His grace, His provision. And then chapter 4 is a big therefore. Walk in a manner worthy of your calling, instruction in godliness. This is the pattern. New life. Walk in this way. Walk in love. Children, parents, husbands, wives, bondservants, masters. This is how I want you to be. And then the charge or the call to respond. Finally, put on the full armor of God. This is our response. Take up the shield in all circumstances. So you see the epistolatory pattern, the same pattern bubbles up over and over and over again in the Bible. And it informs how it is that we worship. So what is the principle, the biblical principle of worship? That'd be the next slide. What is the biblical principle of worship? Worship is and should always be a retelling of the gospel. When I was, Ricky will remember this, and if there's anybody else, it was on the search committee that I spoke to. Is anybody else in the room that was on that committee? Maybe not. A couple of you. Kay was there. Early on, we talked about worship. And I introduced the idea at that time of the ark. There should be an ark to worship. That's just another way of saying a retelling of the gospel. The ark of worship. The arrows that point from beginning to end with a climaxing point, a high point in the worship service, which is the preaching of the word. And it all should point to a retelling of the gospel itself, because worship is always about what? God. And when we see God, we experience His grace so that we can enjoy God. And then He sends us out on mission. So, the biblical paradigm of worship, Old Testament, Isaiah chapter 6. Man encounters God, God's character revealed, my character revealed, God's grace offered, God's grace received. Instruction on how to live, and a charge, a response, a therefore, a go. Worship is found, that pattern is found in the prophets. It's found at Mount Sinai. It's found in the temple. There's other places where we could go to. I should know this. Second Chronicles. Where is it? When Solomon builds the temple, chapter 16 is it? And same paradigm happens there. Same thing. God's character. God's holiness. My need. God's grace to meet my need. So the worship service should and must always tell the story of the gospel, because that same paradigm is brought into the new with greater fulfillment and with a tremendous amount of freedom and flexibility. So long as that is the story that is told, we are on good, solid biblical grounds. Okay? There's more to all of this. The next time we're together, we will talk about these, the elements and forms right there, the elements and forms of worship. Forms, elements, and some people would say the circumstances of worship. So it's 7:15 now, so that's where we're going to go next. The next time we're together, we'll flesh out for us how this telling of the gospel in worship takes form, how it takes shape in specific detail. And that will begin to reflect Surfside Church. We'll have some very practical examples of why we're doing this. So my goal in this, and by the way, one of the things that I'll do before we're done with this Wednesday night little series here, is I'm going to introduce you to two different kinds of structures. I'm going to introduce you to the physical structures of churches from Rome to the Reformation with Luther and Calvin, and then our tradition out of the Westminster Assembly, which informs how this building is built. There's a reason that this building is built like this. This is very reformational. And there's all kinds of theology in this building. Do you know that? When you look around here, there is all manner of theology. I'll give you two examples. Number one, what do you notice about these two pieces of furniture? This one and this one. One of them is higher than the other. And when we have the Lord's Supper, I come down here and I stand behind the table. There's theology in this. You know this? There's a reason I stand right here. I don't come here and stand here. Why not?
Between you.
That's right. I am not between you and the sacrament. What's that all about? Where does that come from? These little things I want you to begin grasping and holding on to. So when we get to this whole thing on the structures, one of the slides that would come up next is something about structures that tell stories. Yeah, physical structures. And there's the structure of a worship service that also tells a story. And everything is telling the same story. Our building, our structures, the pulpit, the table, the choir. Boy, there's theology. Do you know that? The fact that these are congregants and members of the church that are singing is dripping with biblical theology. We'll get to all that. Why do we do things the way we do them? Why is it that, and how is it that we are shaped by the different things that we do in worship? That's what I want us to get and hold on to, so that I promise you this, when we get those things, your experience of worship on Sunday mornings will be far richer and greater, because you'll understand why we do things and how those things are meant to shape us. So we're going to talk about forms and elements and forms and circumstances. We're going to talk about structures of buildings, and I can't avoid history, so I'll show you some interesting historical things on how buildings were done in churches and what the stories are being told there. And then the worship services. We'll go back and we'll look from the earliest days of worship services into the Reformation, and we'll see this pattern. And at the end of it, I'm going to show you how all of these patterns have one thing in common, which is it tells the same story of God's glory, man's need, God's grace offered and received, God's instruction, and his gracious call to response. That's what carries the day all the way through. So I get excited about this stuff. I hope you get excited about a little bit of a teaser tonight, just to get a little, the main point tonight is to lay down a biblical paradigm of worship, so you know you have some way of thinking about this from a biblical place, okay? Any comments for tonight or questions? Go ahead, Dawn. I'll repeat it because I think we're being recorded, so I'll repeat it for this. Oh, so the definition of, yeah, it's a lot. The definition of holy is connected to the idea of weight, weightiness. Now, I'm accessing some old files here, so somebody can Google this and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think Hebrew word for holy is the word kabod, which is the word for heavy. So the idea here is holiness of God separates him as pure and infinitely perfect and untouched, unstained by anything less than himself. That's kind of what the picture of holiness is. It's connected to his glory. They're not unrelated ideas and concepts. Yeah. Worship begins with what? God. We begin with God, that leads us to what? The sin, myself, my need. And God provides what? Grace. He offers it. He provides it. We receive it. We are therefore renewed in this grace. And then he doesn't leave us alone. He instructs us. He sends us out with a final charge. That's the story of the Christian life. That's the story of the worship service. And believe it or not, it's the story of our structures. So that's where we're going to be going. Okay. I hope you are joyful about this. I can't wait to show you the pictures of Luther's pulpit and Calvin's pulpit and these kinds of things. I've got them here, and we'll enjoy that. Let me pray.